Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit Dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
Astonishing Legends Network.
The views and opinions expressed by hosts and listeners on the Astonishing Dead Letter Office are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of Astonishing Legends Productions, the Astonishing Legends Network, or any affiliated entities or guests.
When something unexplainable happens to you, it can make you feel isolated or alone. But trust us, you're not. For over a decade, you've been sending your strange stories to Astonishing Legends. And now it's time for our fellow legenders to hear them too. Join us weekly in Blanket Fortiana as we dig through your intriguing messages to the Astonishing Dead Letter Office.
Tonight's episode, What Does a House Remember?
Tonight, we're headed across the pond, over the river, and through the woods to Grandma's house, Gran's house, sort of, as you'll hear, into some old border country between England and Wales. Really rich area with a lot of history. But we're going to a house that's been long-standing enough to have outlived nearly everyone who ever loved it. And maybe it's okay with that. The house is okay with that.
Yeah, this is the Welsh Marches. That's the proper name for this area. Shropshire, pressed right up against the Welsh border. For centuries, this was kind of a rough scene between two countries. You had the Marcher Lords out here in the medieval period, somewhat independent barons holding a frontier that frequently got raided from both directions, castles every few miles. It was a lot going on. And then the whole thing just, it went quiet. Things calmed down for a long, long time, probably longer than America has existed. But today, it's some of the most thinly populated old country in England. It's the Stiperstones, the Long Mynd, the Severn winding through market towns that were already ancient when the Tudors turned up a little bit later.
Yeah, and this isn't your typical Hollywood haunted house haunting style kind of thing either, you know, with the rattling chains and the moaning and this and that. I mean, in a Hollywood sense, the movies, everybody wants to leave. Now, that's certainly the case for a lot of stories we also get where people are just like, we can't deal with this. But we've found over the years, there's a fair number of stories that we've come across where there's actually what sounds like chains rattling.
Yeah.
One of the creepiest ones comes from someone who was a mortuary technician, somebody who was responsible for embalming and treating and preparing the bodies that came through in the basement at night for the night shift for the day crew to start working on. And they actually heard like clanging and chains being dragged. So there's a few other tropes in this, but for some reason, the chain dragging is one of them, but not for tonight. We have a few others.
A little Jacob Marley action.
No, yeah, I see what you mean. It's that there is something about that. And there's another, it's not a trope in that I believe it's fictitious because it comes up in so many stories of people that we find credible. That there's something about the appearance, let's say, of whatever this thing is. And that is a recurring theme like so many. So what's going on here? That's what we want to know. But there's also a lovely little story that this is wrapped up in. And when we're talking about these things that are less likely to happen and the things that are more, the ones that seem to ring more true to us are much more subtle, I'll say.
I would agree with that.
But in this story, there is the unexplained. But I love how it's dealt with and how it's experienced, because these all don't have to be horrific, terrible stories. They can be heartwarming and inspiring in many ways.
I'll only say this. Notice how gentle the story is. It's not a story that's necessarily trying to scare you. If anything, It's a story about being looked after. So, Forrest, I think it is your turn to read this one. So why don't you take us into this house in England?
I would very much like to tell you a small story about some experiences we had upon first moving into our home in a small village in Shropshire, England, near the Welsh border. It's a beautiful old early Victorian villa, 1840s, in need of renovation, and we, me, my husband, and our two young daughters, were very excited to embark on this new adventure together in 2019. It was empty as we moved in because the previous owner, Betty, had died 18 months previously at the impressive age of 94, having lived in and loved the house since 1961. The house felt a bit sad and unloved, being empty so long, but we knew it just needed a bit of life in it, and some fresh paint. Betty had been a headmistress at a local school and had a special place in her heart for both children and dogs, so our new neighbors assured us that we, having both, would have met her approval. The first experience happened when I was at the house with my youngest daughter, who was 3.5 years old at the time. We hadn't fully moved in yet, and I was shuttling necessities from our rented house to this new home. People were dropping in to see the place, and after 2 days of this, the third day had to be spent at the rental house, tidying and packing. My daughter asked to go back to the new home to see the old lady. My gran had visited during the week, and I thought she was referring to her. I asked if she met Big Granny, my gran, her great-gran, and she said no. She met the old lady with the white hair and the things all over her face. What things, darling? Black things all over her face. Well, I shut that one down for later inspection and carried on with the packing. After we'd moved in, I felt the atmosphere in the house lifting. It was genuinely friendly and welcoming, and it wasn't just us that said so. Everyone who visits loves this house. I did have a strong sense in those first few months of being gently inspected. It was nothing sinister, just a sense of being watched from a distance, which dispelled after a few months. However, a few weeks after moving in, I got irritated at the kids for some reason and yelled at them, and immediately felt incredibly guilty, like I'd been properly told off. It was just a feeling, probably a good dose of mum guilt too, but it was very odd. On the whole, the house has never given us a reason to be scared, though I don't love the cellars. And even if I like ghost stories and podcasts, they were definitely something I didn't share with the kids. We're a close family, and the kids were still young, so we dealt with the usual nightmares and waking up you have with children, but nothing out of sorts. I thought it best to wait and see if they said anything about the house, rather than provoke any made-up stories to satisfy Mum. But they didn't mention anything over the usual bumps and bangs of an old house with wonky plumbing. It was only about 6 months ago, on a long car journey with my youngest, that we were flicking through podcasts and we saw a ghostly one that she wanted to listen to. And she's 9 now, so I thought it would be fun. One of the experiencers recalled seeing a figure in their house with no facial features, but inside some lines across the face that looked like static on an old TV. Black and white wavy lines. My youngest stopped the podcast and said, "Mummy, that's what I saw." I asked her to elaborate, and she said that after we had moved in, once or twice she'd seen an old lady in her house with white hair and black squiggly things across where her face should be. She wasn't very scared, as the figure wasn't threatening, but instead just seemed a bit lost. She assumed that it was Betty, the previous owner, as we had spoken about her and how she'd loved the house as much as us, not telling them that she'd passed away in the room we'd chosen for the girls' bedroom. And we only heard that after we'd moved them in. Honest. She stopped seeing her after just one occasion at night in her bedroom that she shared with her elder sister. She slept on the bottom of the bunk bed, and she was woken up by Betty climbing into bed with her. Again, she didn't feel particularly scared, but it was when Betty started snoring and talking in her sleep that she asked her to get out and please leave her alone. She went back to sleep and apparently didn't see her again. This story came straight from her lips, not a stumble whilst she was telling it, and I knew that she was sincere. She was surprised herself, as hearing the other story had unlocked the memory for her that had been semi-forgotten. Betty getting kicked out of bed and not being seen again seems to coincide with the time I felt the presence dissipating. I've concluded that Betty, who had adored the house, was hanging around a little to check that the old place was in safe hands before moving on. Sometime after that, I found an old terracotta plaque in a cupboard that I've kept ever since that read, "Kind and dear is the old house here." It felt deeply appropriate. I don't know if you've come across the books of Lucy M. Boston. She wrote the Children of the Green Now series about an ancient house and its layers of inhabitants. She also wrote a sort of biography about her life at the house where it's set, Hemingford Gray, which is a truly ancient house called Memory in a House. She posits the notion that many houses, over time, appear to develop a distinct personality of their own that expresses itself in various observable ways and the love and care it engenders in its owners. I feel very much that this is the case in our house. Looking at its evidential history, it has been occupied for long periods of time by formidable women. 40 years, from 1888 to 1918, by Lady Harnage, stalwart widow of the village who taught Bible classes to young boys in our sitting room. And 56 years by Betty, who is similarly well known in the locality. I like to think I'm the next strong woman, with two further strong little women, to hold this house, fitting it up for the new century as my predecessors have done for theirs. We're very happy here and intend to be here for some time. Thanks for reading, and I'll be happy to clarify any points for you if you intend to use the story for the Dead Letter Office. With much appreciation for your excellent podcast and the many hours of fascinated listening it has given to me. After these messages, we'll be right back. And now back to the show.
Well, there's a lot of things about the story that are super fascinating and endearing and comforting. And I like Lucy's overall take on it. That's the name of our listener, who also mentions an author named Lucy. But it's true. Those two people have the same name in this case. When the face is described as having no facial features, but inside some lines across it that looked like static on an old TV, that's just like, okay, yeah, that's pretty intense. Why do you have a staticky face? What's going on there?
Are we getting into the faces now, the portion of this?
I kind of want to a little bit because that's the thing that jumps out at me the most about this.
I was going to say I have a handful of notes here, and we might as well jump into it because it's one of the most prominent things about the story.
Yeah.
And we'll talk about the background and a little bit of the history of the house later, but this aspect, as I said in our cold open, our pre-ramble on my part, is there are tropes, you could say, or motifs, really, about the genre of ghosts and sightings and interactions. And chains is one of them, certain sounds, footsteps, knocks, raps, of course, those are all historical things that have been tracked. And another one could be apparel or appearance, a little bit, you know, the old lady, the old hag at the foot of the bed. That's a different thing, I think, going on than what we typically find with these types of houses. That's its own trope, you could say, or subgenre. And there are things about the appearance, the lady in white.
Yeah.
Always wearing something white. What is that about? What's important about the clothing? Like I said, there's other areas that branch out when I do my pattern tracking that I can't help but do. But one thing's the horns. Why the horns? What's going on there? It's been described in so many other things, like shadow people kind of things, not just demonic entities, but like shadow people in different colored varieties we've talked about before. Some being a total solid, bright version of a color, a hue or tint. That is over their whole being, their whole person. And one of the main things, though, is the face. Is it something akin to, we know in the spirit world, that has a lot of meaning, carries a lot of weight, the name? Names are important. You'll see that with demonologists and priests doing exorcists. Having the name of something gives you access to it in a universal spiritual way. but you have to know who you're addressing exactly. And if you don't, then it's like, that's not me you're trying to exercise. That's somebody else who was here centuries ago. But there's something about the face that's iconic, not just in the storytelling, but apparently on the other side with spirit, as a general term here, with the spirit world, the underworld, the overworld, this and that. And is that part of the identity? And when you don't have that, is that something? Because what, let me put it this way. You've seen, what comes to mind immediately is Spielberg's movie AI, where yes, the robot beings, the sentient, intelligent, advanced race now that is biomechanical or just all mechanical in the future, they have kind of like screens for faces where they show emotions or whatever they're thinking. And that's just kind of an expression. It's like a visualizer that you might see on some music in a YouTube clip, like we used to have with our stories playing, is that it's a visual expression, yes, of what's going
have,
on. We still have those, yes.
For now.
Right.
Yes. And there's plans afoot. I'll just sneak that
yeah,
in.
Yeah, we're trying to up and zhuzh and glow it up, whatever.
Yes.
But that is a visual component to whatever intellectual or thinking that's going on. And there are several stories I want to mention here from the past. One, recently, I think, it was a DLO that we had just recorded, but it involved somebody driving by a young woman on the side of the road.
Oh, yeah, I remember that one. That was in LA, I think.
Right, somewhere outside, but involved a car crash. And there was a car that went missing that they think they didn't know where it was. And then somebody drove by and saw a young woman curled up on the side of the road, I believe wearing some kind of white dress or robe.
Oh, this is
or
different. Okay.
Something.
Yeah, yeah.
But
yeah,
didn't appear to have a face, or they couldn't see the face. There was something about it, so they didn't really know who it was. They came back. She was not there, but the police investigated further and then found the crashed car. And it was one of those miracle things where the child in the seat was still alive, even after a few days had passed with no food or water. But the mother had passed. So a bit of a crisis yeah, apparition story. There's another story about, I think it came from Paranormal Witness, also something about a woman walking by the side of the road, all in white. But what freaked out the person driving by was that the woman had no face. And again, I don't know if that's maybe symbolically, tangibly in a way that where your identity connected to that face is gone or in some kind of limbo, where it does not appear to the viewer, the person witnessing this. It's kind of like not there.
Or is it like maybe some kind of screen memory or something?
Yeah, you could have blocked it out. But I've heard people, I think when you're not expecting it, you know, you expect to see a face. Your first thought is like, oh, this woman walking by the side of the road is a ghost. I wonder what she looks like. It's just there's something that's not there about it, if you know what I mean. So I think that Paranormal Witness story, that was in the same episode of the three stories, of one of my favorite here. I think season one, episode three, where it also had either the Rainmaker story with it, but also one of the most chilling demonic stories. The mother who had a daughter there with her boyfriend living there and just a lot of bizarre activity that they captured on video, like the oven door just banging open and close continuously for an hour.
Oh, yeah.
Somebody yeah, making, taking, dumping the entire contents of the refrigerator out on the floor and then sticking Ritz bits or Cheez-Its to the wall in patterns with peanut butter.
Oh, yes. Yeah, yeah. I remember that. Yeah.
And they were just yeah, at their wit's end. And then it was the daughter and then the daughter's friend who was living there with them. And then the boyfriend. That's the one where they tried to.
That's like, remember the footprints from the vertical plane?
Yeah. That went something, up the there's wall? Something about walls yeah, too and where you yeah, can walk and you're applying this to other than just to mess it up. It was actually in patterns because, again, they videotaped a lot of this, but they tried to make peace with it and did a little candle. And they had a ceramic little cat right, sculpture, and they were trying to appease it, which is, that's like Churchill saying, when you try to appease tyrants, it's like feeding a crocodile, hoping you're the last one to get eaten. Right. It's not a way to approach this, but they were trying their best. They didn't know right, what they were doing. And then the boyfriend comes in and he's really upset about all of that. And he takes the cat sculpture, the little ceramic yes,
this
thing.
This is my favorite apportation.
Yeah, he throws it out in the yard, and then they, you know, saying like, stop, you got to stop with this. They turned around, and it's back on the table.
Yeah, like it was on the table or the counter, I right, think, by the kitchen or something, and they had a sliding glass door, and they open it up.
Yeah,
he chucks it through the door all way into the backyard,
yeah,
ranting the whole time. Turns around, it's sitting right where he picked it
right,
up from.
Yeah, so that was a chock full episode, but it did have that story, and I remembered that. And then I'd heard a story from Jim Harold's campfire that I always remembered. And this one's similar, but this has another tie-in in that a guy was at his house and he looks out the front window at night, late at night, and he sees what pops up as a woman with a face, but it looked like the face had been deteriorated quite a bit or decomposed and it was all white. And you can kind of make out the facial features. And this is 10, 15 years ago. So I'm going to spoil it for you. But the idea was that he saw this, he freaked out. He's totally terrified. Of course, nothing's outside. And then as the backstory goes, his aunt, who he says was very lovable, feisty, but a bit of a barfly, got a ride home from someone she should not have. And they didn't find the body for a while. And when they did, it had been in water. And he said the photo of her postmortem was that face, where basically the face had kind of melted away. So he said that was the face. And so that was gone. And it's like, that can happen, I think, and be a residual image that carries through into whatever the spirit is. Here is not the case, but I do wonder, what are the black things over the face that she described?
That's pretty wild.
Or the static, like what's going on with the representation of the face? Because, you know, it's one of the markers, the most important things everybody notices when you interact with other humans and other beings. Everyone's got some kind of a face.
Yeah.
And that's how you identify and locate them. Even over time, your face changes, of course, with age, but it's still there. The person's still there. So when there is no face or there's something on the face, like black things, as she said, black things all over her face. Like, what is that a representation of? And is it something having to do with Betty's actual passing or decomposition?
Yeah.
I don't know.
That's a good question.
But yeah, it's like, that's a disturbing thing because again, you see something and even if you think it's a ghost, that you can maybe deal with, but it's a ghost with no face. That is even more disturbing.
Yeah, that's a problem.
But
that's
a
no for me, dog, as they say.
Yeah,
like, but I'm not down with that.
Story, though, like I said, I love the attitude of Lucy and her family that they're accepting of this and in a good light. But it also has to do with the feeling that this experience is giving to them is that it's not scary, although it can be a little unnerving. And what I love is the daughter, it wasn't that disturbing until Betty started snoring.
rolling
around. And then it's like anybody else. Remember the Coen brothers movie True Grit and Haley Steinkamp? They gave her the room with the older lady who steals all the blankets and snores loudly all night.
Yes.
That annoys anybody. But like people or spirits doing their old usual things in their place because they still have some strong connection to it, I think is the anchor to this story is that Betty loved her house. She was a strong woman and she sounds like a rule follower. And so in life, and she wanted to make sure that these folks were good, that things were being properly taken care of. So she could RIP, rest in peace.
I guess Shropshire has no shortage of other local lore. One, I think we mentioned just recently on another show, unless I'm mistaken, the White Lady of Ludlow Castle. There's also the Stiperstone's Devil's Chair, which was apparently a meeting place for witches, which is pretty interesting. Yeah. And another one that came up in our research was the Long Men's Lost Village, whose sounds of life are still said to be heard on certain nights.
Well, that's fascinating. Tell us a little more about that if you've got the info.
Well, I mean, that story in itself is pretty folklore heavy. Hmm. And the Long Mend is the long mountain. It's a section of land.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of spooky stories there. Apparently, there is a phantom funeral that people have seen on the road toward Ratlinhope, Ratlinghope. And this is like a horse-drawn hearse that moves super fast. There's also like a black shuck situation,
nice.
A devil hound, which of course they're everywhere. I guess Ratlinhope is pronounced locally Ratchup. So there's a lot of stories of like time slip kind of things
that
are happening all in this area, which would make sense given the age of it. But the reality is the whole area is made up of lots of places where there were little villages that are all gone now because people have just been living there forever.
Right,
and things have come and gone. And some things have been in place the whole, some places have been in place the whole time. others are gone. So it seems like among the folklore that you look up for this area are stories of people hearing and encountering things that shouldn't be there that seem like they're echoes from the past, yeah. Which of course makes you wonder about this. And also, how old are these characters that you're encountering? And they have an idea for this, mm-hmm. and what they think. And I think their idea makes sense, because the other thing that's fascinating to me about this story is whenever we encounter stories like this where people are interacting with something,
yeah.
and they're making a connection about who or what it might be, I feel like most of the time it seems to be right. It seems to be on track. If there's a way to nail it down, it seems like there's some kind of psychological connection between the living and the dead in these scenarios, because we have so many of them where it's like, well, we named it so-and-so. And then they find out later, guess what? This person was here, and that's what they got. So even if you're wrong about the thing you're encountering, you've magically pulled the name out of a hat of someone that had passed in the area or like was a legendary resident of the place that you're living in. So I think there's a lot to be said for what people think they're dealing with, because I think that's more than just guessing in these kinds of scenarios. I think it's more intimate than that.
Yeah, there's something, like I said, that's the important aspect to a lot of these stories is the identifier or identification. And I've told this story before, but like at one of the places I worked at for a long time as a freelancer, or as I called it, permalancing, where you're freelance, but you're there for years. And the building manager, there was a resident ghost at the building, and it wasn't old. It was built, I think, in the early 90s. Little small things would happen. I experienced a few of those. And I was talking to the building manager at the time, and he said, like, oh, yeah, that's George. And I said, do you know, did somebody named George pass away here? He goes, no, that's just the feeling I get. That's just what I call him. That's just a name that kind of, not it popped into my head, because, yeah, I think that's his name. But yeah, there's something about this identity and how that's warped or changed. So you're talking about names of people that sometimes connect. And then, you know, people find a way, like I said, this also reminded me a little bit about the Conjuring House. Remember that moving in story where the mom, she was moving in and they got their kids helping and they're bringing stuff in from the car and the moving van. And there was a guy there that was, I think they all saw him, like he was just standing there or was in the parlor or something and looked totally normal and real. Yeah. And he was like, oh, I'm here to check on the house or do some real estate stuff. Then he just kind of, you know, everybody turns around, he's just gone. And it's just one of the many spirits bound up there. He looked real as anything else, like a real human.
That is the other thing. And I think we mentioned this on a recent episode as well, that when listener Lucy mentioned the author, Lucy Boston, and the Children of the Green Nose series, the books, and then the other one in Hemingford Gray called Memory in a House, which is very cool. And saying that this author, Boston, put together a notion that many houses develop a personality that expresses itself in certain particular ways. And this was something I think that we talked about just an episode or two ago, because we've had a couple here that have been about houses in a row. And just this idea that maybe that personality is made up of varying levels of hauntings or participation from deceased prior people that have passed through it. And somehow that becomes like, as you like to say, a bouillabaisse of spirits. Like it's a recipe for a particular kind of haunting, and maybe why when you're dealing with it, you can't just think of it as this one-on-one battle with particular entities, in so much as you have a recipe of things that maybe you've got to figure out what works the best with. What's a good wine with this dish?
Yeah,
You're going to have a problem just taking the pepper out of it, or it's got too much cumin. You know, it's more complicated.
Well, it's so nebulous on that side of what's going on. Even when you talk to spiritual mediums who claim to have a bit more knowledge they can impart about the scenario you're in, but it reminds me also of the Sludge Entity House, and that there are several spirits there, several which are good, but bound by a larger negative force that is keeping them there because they derive some power.
Which is the theory on the Sally House as well.
Yeah, there's a bunch of things coming in and out of there. I mean, it could be a larger portal too, where it's the like Ghostbusters. It's you've opened up the gates, and now all kinds of things are flooding in, like the Slimer. And everything in you can imagine.
It's the light at the end of the tunnel for the things trapped in the darkness.
Yeah,
and when the light comes on, they all gravitate towards it. And sometimes maybe there's a gatekeeper that also wants to capitalize on all the things that are showing up and control them somehow.
Right. It's so hard to nail down. If you remember from the Sludge Entity, the recurring lucid dreams the one child was having was of a Native American warrior or shaman,
right,
or medicine man, somebody that was trying to do battle and fight for good with his family. But things are kind of like anachronistic, maybe, like the image that he said the child did is that, yeah, it's like a Native American guy, and he's got a sword and there's a jewel at the end of it that glows. It's like, well, that's not really fitting with the,
right. So now
with the narrative. And you think, well, that's a child's
now
imagination.
Now we're in the Marvel universe.
Yeah, he's, right. Well, but who, like I said, if that child's, one of the children's descriptions that is accurate, who knows what's going on? But I think where you get, you get led down the wrong path if you try to apply our waking everyday fictional narratives to stuff. It's like, well, that doesn't make sense. Because why would he have that? It's like, listen, you don't know what the rules are, what's going on the other side, other than you get these generalized impressions. And so a lot of times, like I said, it's negative, but you also have other good entities. I heard a story also of there was a bad, very negative and powerful entity that was terrorizing this family. But they did some cleansing rituals, but also there was the spirit of a past family member, like an uncle or a father, that was trying to protect them, but didn't have enough power, as much power as this thing that was terrorizing the family. And then when they did this cleansing ritual, the word they got from a medium is like, yeah, you did that. It weakened, you know, the powerful thing a little bit, but it really dampened the energy and power of the relative trying to help.
Right.
So you got rid of the baby with the bathwater.
Right.
And so,
right.
You know, there's other things going on that are trying to do battle on the other side. You just can't see it. And what you see is the aftermath, which is a lot of knocks and noises and spooky things showing up and feelings. Again, this also has a lot to do with feeling. When she said she yelled at the kids and, you know, every parent would know, it's like, it's justified, but you still feel bad, you know, and you hopefully make up for it. But she instantly felt this guilt and like a little bit of being shamed or dressed down, talked down to, put in her place. And she said it was a very odd feeling. And what I gather was that the reason it felt odd was because it was not her feeling of guilt. Not later, like, I probably yelled at them a little too loudly. But my wits were short at an end. So you get an immediate feeling. I also believe that feelings and emotions can be passed from the spirit world entities to the living. So that's a fascinating thing. And just kind of the background of the appearances and feelings, like climbing into bed, that's a common thing. And you know,
yeah,
it's not you, or it's just the living person already in the bed knows it's not a fluke, like, oh, maybe I'm just shifting around, or you know when something climbs into bed with you.
Yeah.
And the feeling you get, like I said, from the documentary, The Nightmare, the woman, she was too scared to turn around and see what had climbed into bed with her when she was alone in her place and there shouldn't have been anybody there. And later she found out there wasn't anybody there, but like felt the bed pressing down, the weight of it, something next to her trying to be the spirit of her mother or that presence. And not that it was malicious, but what upset her was that she knew it wasn't the spirit of her mom, who had recently passed. It was something pretending to be the mother. And again, it wasn't evil, just like that's disturbing. Like you don't want anybody impersonating your loved ones, you know, after they pass.
Yeah, right.
In life or in death. So that's just upsetting. It was like, get out. And so like with Betty, it's like, we love you, but you got to get into a bed that no one's in. Like don't climb in a bed because I can't sleep now. You're snoring too loudly.
And also, we're going to try and find you a CPAP machine or maybe you should try a Breathe Right strip or something. Because
those don't really work for me, but have at it if if that's your trick. But like I said, that's just more of an annoyance of from the living, like it's a more common thing. But the interesting part is that she asked her to leave and then she left.
Yeah.
And that's when Lucy says that coincides around the time with Betty getting kicked out of the bed and not being seen again, also coincides with her feeling about her presence dissipating and like, okay, I can see, sorry, I just love this house. But I can see you're taking good care of it. You're good parents. I love the kids. And I think you're fine here. And maybe that was the release Betty was needing to move on to wherever her next destination is. But getting back to the eyes without a face, just that's the reverse of it. I've also heard stories.
Good old Billy.
Good old Billy. I threw that in just because we share the same birthday. But
yeah,
that's the reverse, where I've heard other stories too. One from a good friend of ours whose father, who's a real no-nonsense tough guy, saw a pair of disembodied eyes darting right at him coming from the ceiling.
Right.
That took place in Vietnam when he was fighting that war.
Yeah.
But again, the face, the eyes, there's something significant about that that still carries meaning. So I do wonder about that. And I was going to say also that was a chilling description in a Peter Straub book, the acclaimed horror writer, in his book Shadowland. Somebody showed up at the door.
I've heard of that. I haven't read it. I say, oh yeah, only because I'm familiar with the title, but I don't know the.
It keys in with the face, and there's, again, no shortage of face-related stories here, of having no face or some kind of distorted face sometimes, which is also very disturbing, or a decomposed face, or, like I said, eyes with no face.
Yeah.
Was there any time that you were at a facility, and I know you and I have not had a lot of experiences like this, but I do remember one where it was disturbing but not frightening, but you wanted to get away, like in the basement in the workshop at the Kent Stage Theater.
In that particular case, it was both. I did experience fear, but not fear of what I thought had happened or what it was, more of a fear of death or of sudden death.
Interesting.
It was connected to the story that I had not heard yet.
That's right.
You had not dying of the heart attack.
That's right. Yeah. That was told to us later.
So it was more like, oh God, I'm dying. That's what that was that fear.
That's what I was.
I didn't think I was dying. I wasn't literally panicked.
Yeah, sure, sure.
But it was a feeling that was adjacent to that.
Okay. The reason I asked that is because we're talking about feelings and emotions being passed to, you know, from the past, not P-A-S-T, P-A-S-S-E-D. From the past to the living, in that you experienced perhaps what the theater maintenance guy experienced, because down in his workshop is where he had his heart attack, which is a story we heard later.
Yeah.
And that he's experiencing that, like, I'm having a heart attack or an angina, and he cannot breathe, and he feels like he's going to die, and there's a lot of fear and pain associated with that. Do you think that that's maybe a little of what you experienced of his last moments there?
I don't know. Like, I don't have a good handle on what it was, but there's obviously, for me, you know, it seems like a connection. Of course, hindsight's 20/20,
sure.
Especially in the case of a paranormal encounter like this, that aligns with something that actually happened.
Right.
And I don't have a long life of those kinds of experiences. So I don't have a lot to say. I was like, oh yeah, well, that's it. Reminds me of this happened to me dozens of times. That's one of like three times in my life that something freaky has happened
that.
So, but it was very real. It was very visceral feeling.
I was
feeling.
Standing right next to you, and you looked a little green around the gills.
Yeah, yeah. Was
then
was
as soon as you walked up, it kind of dissipated.
When I got up to the out of the basement, I was much better.
Yeah.
Because at first I was very comforted down there because it reminded me of my great-grandparents' house.
Right. There you go.
My great-grandfather had like a shop that was very similar. All the smells and the old tools and all the stuff that was down there was comforting to me.
Yeah.
And then that changed like on a dime.
Yeah. That's another, since we're talking about old buildings and houses, and they do have a resonant kind of a vibe to them, and how that can change. And just, again, the stuffiness of it. I liked how they were describing, Lucy had described, you know, once they started renovating and they started living in it a little bit more, the mood lifted. Not that the mood was bad before, just stuffy, a little rundown, a little bit of neglect that just happens with time and, you know, not being cared for immediately. And once you start moving in, it's all life, living energy, I think, which is palpable. Scientists are looking into that as being a real thing, energy having effect later on, and is that kind of subatomic level kind of a thing where you do have entanglement and spiritual entanglement and subatomic entanglement where there's a connection to things past and energies past. And so as soon as you start talking about energies and this and that and buildings and people start rolling their eyes, which I get. I understand that. But when you go to a place and you feel something, I don't think it's always just your imagination because you've been listening to a spooky podcast on the drive there. Because a lot of times you don't expect that, or you have the opposite reaction, like, well, this should be fun. And you go in, and it's like, no, that place is wrong. And then sometimes the reverse, where you thought it was going to be spooky and creepy. And then it's like, no, it seems kind of fine here. So I love that about the story here, that they had a good experience with this. And I'm glad that the young girls are being given the right attitude and to not be afraid of it, whatever that might be, to be aware and stand up for yourself, like asking, you know, okay, you got to get out of bed. I can't sleep. And, you know, just go, please go away. So to stand up for yourself, the right things are being taught here. And again, not to fear it or deny it and stamp those things down. It's like, you acknowledge it. Like, this is how I'm really feeling. And this is the backstory. And we don't know how these things work exactly, but it's nothing to be afraid of. And the things that you are displeased with, it's okay to stand up for yourself and to assert yourself in this new place, because now it's yours, and to take ownership of it. And I do see a lot of other stories. We all know these, where you get a haunted house story because the person doesn't want you in there. And I understand that too, having a, you know, an old house to go to that you were raised in or you cared for. And maybe it's not, you know, things aren't being done the way you like, because how many times have we heard there's a bit of construction or renovation that happens, and then that kicks up the spirit activity because, like, wait, what are you doing? I put in that wall for a purpose, and now you're tearing it down. It's like, I don't like that. It's like, yeah, well, it's ugly. You yourself said it wasn't appreciated at the time when you were alive, but we're making this our own. And, you know, so I'm the mind. I get that. And a person's space is sacred in many ways to them, but you're gone now. You have to let go. Things change. That happens as you get older too. You don't like change. You want the routine. You want the same things. You worked your whole life for something and you want it to be the same always, but you also have to realize you are in another phase and great things await you if you would just let go of the past, because it may have been your past, but now it's not your present.
Well, it's very interesting, Forrest, that you're talking about all of that and what a home means and what it means to different people and the past and the present. Couldn't agree with you more. There is something about this story that is, it's a little bit scary and spooky, but it's also very comforting. And I got really curious about the plaque that Lucy said she found in the cabinet. And I went to look that up, and it turns out it is connected to a poet and a famous Victorian England designer named William Morris, not of the talent agency in New York, which, by the way, represents us if you need us for anything.
But right.
It's not William Morris Endeavor, right. WME. But a different William Morris, but this name may be familiar to a bunch of you, especially if you're across the pond. He was a giant of the arts and crafts movement in Victorian England, a designer, a printer, poet, and the wallpaper and textile stuff that he did. If you just Google William Morris patterns, you're going to see a million things that you recognize. Beautiful stuff, still being used regularly today. And I guess in 1871, he had an old manor house out in the Cotswolds, where everyone is going right now to live near Jeremy Clarkson, apparently. this was in Kelmscott, right on the Thames, and he just was obsessed with this house. And inside the house, there is an old oak four-poster bed, and it has hangings on it that were stitched by hand by his wife, Jane, and his daughter, May. Apparently, she was considered one of the finest embroiderers of her entire generation. So there's roses, birds, a little rabbit. When I look at this stuff, it's so beautiful. Yeah. My wife and I, we have pets. So we have some of those rugs that are pet friendly, and they have beautiful patterns on them. There's a couple of companies that do this. Right. But the patterns, I realize now in one of our rooms, where we have one of these, it looks like something he would have designed. Wow. Just beautiful.
Yeah.
Wildlife and that kind of thing on it. Of course, now it's made by computers and, again, pet friendly. Anyway, Morris wrote a poem about that bed. It's actually called Inscription for an Old Bed, and it's funny for how much of this story centers around the bed and the activity in the home as it relates to bed. So I thought that was pretty interesting. And it contains the line that Lucy referenced and found on that, on that plaque or whatever.
Right.
About the old house being kind and dear, in a cupboard, I should say. So in her own old house, generations and a good ways away from William Morris. So I thought it would be cool, especially since it's in the public domain and we can do this, if for tonight's closeout of this particular Dead Letter Office, Forrest, maybe you could read that.
This is called Inscription for an Old Bed by William Morris. The wind's on the wold, and the night is a cold.
and Thames runs chill, twixt mead and hill. But kind and dear is the old house here, and my heart is warm, midst winter's harm. Rest then, and rest, and think of the best, twixt summer and spring, when all birds sing in the town of the tree, and ye lie in me, and scarce dare move, lest the earth and its love should fade away ere the full of the day. I am old and have seen many things that have been, both grief and peace, and wane and increase. No tale I tell of ill or well, but this I say, night treadeth on day, and for worst or best, right good is rest.
The Astonishing Dead Letter Office is hosted by Scott Philbrick and Forrest Burgess and is executive produced by Tess Feifel. The show is edited and mixed by Sarah Voorhees-Wendell at VW Sound. The theme is based on the Astonishing Legends theme by Judson Crane at Founder Music, arranged by Alan Carissia, who composes all the other music in the show. Tommy Beaver Design created the logo. The announcer is John Bowler. That's me. Stories are lightly edited for length, content, and readability, but otherwise presented as they're sent to us. We're always looking for more dead letters, so if you have a story of your own you'd like to share, email it to deadletteroffice@astonishinglegends.com. Please include how you would like to be credited. First name only, first name last initial, anonymous, a pseudonym. Let us know. Due to the number of emails coming in, we often cannot respond, but we do read them all. No part of the show may be reproduced anywhere without permission. Copyright Astonishing Legends Productions.